We're going to have our Bible reading now from John chapter 20, and it's going to be read to us by Sylvia Banks this morning.
Our Bible reading from John 20 is taken from the New Living Translation. That Sunday evening, the disciples were meeting behind locked doors because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders. Suddenly, Jesus was standing there among them. "Peace be with you," he said. As he spoke, he showed them the wounds in his hands and his side. They were filled with joy when they saw the Lord. Again he said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I am sending you." Then he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, they are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven." One of the 12 disciples, Thomas, nicknamed the twin, was not with the others when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, the disciples were together again, and this time Thomas was with them. The doors were locked, but suddenly, as before, Jesus was standing among them. "Peace be with you," he said. Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and look at my hands. Put your hand into the wound in my side. Don't be faithless any longer. Believe." "My Lord and my God," Thomas exclaimed. Then Jesus told him, "You believe because you have seen me. Blessed are those who believe without seeing me." The disciples saw Jesus do many other miraculous signs in addition to the ones recorded in this book. But these are written so that you may continue to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, you will have life by the power of his name. Thanks be to God.
Doubting Thomas or undoubting Thomas? Have you thought about that before? Because the word doubting comes from one of the expressions that Jesus said in this passage in some translations, "Stop your doubting and believe." And yet that's not, to start with, a good translation of the Greek New Testament word in which this gospel was written. So what does it really mean? Well, let's have a look at it. First of all, doubting or not being sure was not just down to Thomas. Some of the followers of Jesus were a little bit uncertain after the resurrection, and they were uncertain in different ways. And I just thought we'd have a quick look at two of them now. Firstly, on Easter Sunday evening, there were two of Jesus' followers, not among the 12 disciples, who lived in a village a little way away from Jerusalem, and just a walking distance away, in Emmaus. And they were walking home on Easter Sunday evening to Emmaus, having left a lot of Jesus' followers behind, because they had to get home to have their dinner and go to bed and so on. They weren't in central Jerusalem. And on the road to Emmaus, somebody else joined them, and they didn't recognize who it was, and they just got chatting, as you do when you're walking along the road together. And it was Jesus, but he was asking them what seemed like at the time a bit of an odd question about what had been going on. And I love the way in which they replied. I don't love what they replied as, but they changed that quite quickly when Jesus sat down to eat a meal with them. On the road to Emmaus, they told Jesus, "We had hoped he was the Messiah who had come to rescue Israel," because they knew about the death, but they didn't yet know for sure about the resurrection. So all they could think about was the fact that a couple of days or so ago, Jesus had been killed, put to death. We had hoped he was the Messiah who had come to rescue Israel. But fortunately, when they got to their house and Jesus made as if to go further on, they said in good hospitality mode, "Oh, come and have a meal with us." And it was over that meal, as Jesus blessed the meal, that they realized that this was him and he really was risen. But that started with a doubt. And the next one was when Jesus, a little while later, I think, though we're not given the exact date of this, went up to Galilee with most of the disciples. And what we are told is when Jesus did one of his resurrection appearances, when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some of them doubted. And the Greek word for doubted there is a different word from what's used in the Bible reading that we're looking at today. It simply means wavered. It's not that they were unsure in mental terms or in academic terms of what had happened, but they just wavered because what they seemed to feel was, what on earth is going on here? Which is different from the Thomas feeling. Some of them wavered. So this kind of uncertainty was not at all uncommon. And as we hear later on in the New Testament, there are quite a lot of people who are seeing Jesus and believing, and a number of them are not quite sure what was going on. So it leads us to ask the question, is Thomas's situation different? Is it Thomas's or Thomas? Is Thomas, Thomas's, isn't it really? But only with one S. Thomas's different situation. What we read is that Thomas was not with the rest of the disciples on Easter Sunday evening. And don't you think that seems a little bit odd? Because it seems that all the rest of the disciples were actually there at that time when Jesus came. So what on earth was Thomas doing? Well, he must have had something that he had to go off to, because otherwise he wouldn't have just buzzed off like that, because he knew that things were going on. But for some reason, and no doubt it was a good reason, he wasn't there. And Jesus didn't come round later that evening to see Thomas specially. He just left it, and it was the other disciples who said, "We've seen the Lord, we've seen the Lord." And the impact on having been left out of it is not to be underestimated for Thomas, even though he could well have a good reason to be somewhere else. How would you have felt if you were Thomas and all the others had been together and you had to go off and do something else and Jesus had appeared to them, and then when you get back they said, "Oh, we've all seen Jesus." "Oh, why have I been missed out?" Thomas would have said. And this festered for a week. And several expressions to me seem key to give a bit of an understanding of what Thomas was feeling, what we might have been feeling in this situation. Because Thomas was saying here some words which I've underlined, because I would underline them as being so important. He said, "Unless I see the nail marks and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand in his side, I will not believe." This didn't sound like uncertainty to me. It sounded like he was in a bit of a huff. Do you get the idea? He was rather touchy and crotchety at being left out. Well, wouldn't you feel like that if it had been you? He says, well, if I wasn't there at the time, Jesus could have come where I was and said hello to me, couldn't he? But he didn't. "Unless" is the key word to me in this little bit of a passage. "I will not believe." So what happened then after that first Sunday evening? Nothing. For a whole week in relation to Thomas. Because what it says is a week later, the disciples were together again. And this time, Thomas was with them. What happened in that week? Why did Jesus leave it for a week before he came to see them again in that particular grouping? It seems so odd, doesn't it? He could have come on the Monday. You know, he was around. But one of the odd things about the period between the resurrection and ascension is that Jesus kept coming and going, and you never know when he'd come, and you never know when he'd suddenly pop off somewhere else. And you couldn't sort of say to Jesus, well, could you make next Tuesday afternoon, because I'm free then? And Jesus say, no, I'll come Thursday morning. I'm actually going to Tesco then to do my shopping. Oh, no, I'm not going to Tesco. No, don't worry, I'm going to Lidl's because it's their special offers day. But a week passed by, and for Thomas particularly, nothing had happened. That's quite significant, I think. But a week later, which is being celebrated, if I can call it that, this Sunday, the disciples were together again, and this time Thomas was with them. But just as on Easter Sunday, the doors were locked. On Easter Sunday, it tells us in the reading, the doors were locked because the disciples were afraid that some of the Jewish leaders would send round their police, their military, to round them up and crucify them too. So they were locked for safety. And this week later, also the doors were locked because they still were very concerned that the Jewish leaders and indeed the Romans, who sometimes came together in a policing way with the Jewish leaders, might actually come and put them on crosses too. And then you've got that word but coming. Now, but is a very famous Bible word starting verses, and I'm often saying, don't underestimate the but. Actually, in the Greek New Testament, this time, there isn't a but. It just goes to say suddenly. But it's got the meaning of a but. So what's happening is that nothing happened with Thomas for a whole week, and then he joined the rest of them, and the doors were locked. But in spite of the doors being locked, suddenly, as before, Jesus was standing among them. So what do you think Jesus would have done? Well, it would have been logical to expect Jesus to say, oh, hello, Thomas, can I just explain to you the theology of why I've risen and what it is and what I'm doing here, because you obviously were not sure about it. So let me just explain all the detail to you. But he didn't do that. All he did was simply to repeat Thomas's unless stipulations from the week before. Because as Thomas had said to the rest of the disciples afterwards, that what I've got to do is to put my hand there, put my finger there, and actually touch Jesus to know he's there. And I won't believe otherwise. And Jesus said to him exactly those things. Okay, put your finger here, put your hand there, and you can believe. And Thomas's first thought when Jesus was saying this was, who told you I said that? But that's what Jesus said. He didn't argue the case. He didn't look at it academically, or he didn't talk about how the Old Testament prophesied all of these things and led up to it. He could have sat down and said, let's have half an hour together and I'll explain it all to you. And he didn't do that. He said, just, you know, do what you said you wanted to do before. And then at the end of saying that, Jesus said, don't be faithless any longer, believe. Don't be faithless any longer, but believe. And that part of half a verse is what some of the translations say as stop your doubting and believe, which is where the name Doubting Thomas comes from. But it doesn't actually in the Greek say that. It says don't be faithless any longer. But believe. So let's have a look at that word about believing, doubting, whatever, that's used by Thomas originally and by Jesus. It's the same Greek word that both of them use. It has several meanings here, and the first one here, out of the three, it means having faith or not having faith. In the Greek, having faith word is a normal Greek word, And if you want to oppose that by not having faith, you just put a letter A in front of it. And it's a nice way of reversing the meaning of the word. So it means having faith or not having faith. And the second meaning is trusting or not trusting. Trusting or not trusting. Now, these two words are different from doubting in that the word doubting implies, particularly with the last 100 years history, that we're looking at some academic way of doubting. You look at it academically and theologically, but you actually doubt it all. But that word doesn't actually get involved in that at all. It's having faith, which is where you actually dare to step over into a territory that you're not sure of yet. And trusting, so that you're trusting all will work out well, or not. And then the third meaning here is believing. As we just heard, don't be faithless any longer, but believe. And the word in, I've got a really old New Testament Greek to English dictionary. It's about that thick, and it's about that wide, and it tells you all sorts of things that you never ever want to know, but it just translates the Greek word into English, and it's got some really good, helpful translations. And one of its translations for that word for believe, or not believing, is to be incredulous. So I looked that up online on my Cambridge dictionary, and it gives a definition of it that I thought, well, that exactly puts a spot on what Thomas must have been feeling at that time. In the Cambridge Dictionary, incredulous is not wanting or not able to believe something. Because Thomas was not wanting to believe it, was he? Not just not able to believe it, he was in a huff. And usually showing this. So when we think of the so-called doubting Thomas, I thought, well, it's a good way to describe it, not wanting or not able to believe something, and usually showing this. I thought that's not a bad way to put it, is it really? But finally, in this part, looking at the meaning of this doubting or undoubting, and looking at what the Greek words originally, literally, have meant, it says, by no my means will I believe. And I love the way that's put. Because I did a Greek in a certain way, but I need to have a book where you've got the Greek on one line and you've got the English underneath it of those Greek words. Is that somebody's phone or is it? Oh, right, okay. And the literal meaning, when Thomas said it, was, by no means will I believe. And then when Jesus, a week later, uses the same Greek word twice, he means literally, be not faithless, but faithful. And for Thomas, everything changed. He said, by no means will I believe. And Jesus said, using the word twice, once in the positive and once with the A in front of the negative, be not faithless, but faithful. And for Thomas, at that moment, everything changed. And it all hinged on that word that is not really translated doubting. We're going to look at Thomas's response to that in a few moments, when he said, my Lord and my God. But we're going to have a song. What had been changing Thomas all of a sudden to how he changed? Because the expression that he made was not to argue a point back with Jesus, but simply to say, my Lord and my God. Now, in that little phrase, there are three confessions in one. And to my mind, it's one of the most momentous expressions in the Bible, summing up who Jesus is. Because it says three things. It says Lord, it says God, and it says my. Lord, God, and my. If you were looking at the word Lord, particularly in in Greek in those days, it had a wide meaning and a wide range of meanings in everyday Greek language, from something not special at all to something very special. So when Thomas said, "My Lord," he was calling Jesus something which people used in various circumstances. For example, the Lord could be the master of a servant. So if you had a house and there was a servant in it, the servant would call his boss Lord. These days, if you're at work, you would call your manager or director or whatever he or she was called, Lord. That would have been nice, wouldn't it? I was a manager of one or two people at one stage, and if they called me Lord, I would have been quite enjoying that. But Lord was just an ordinary word in Greek used for somebody who was your boss. It was also a word used for an owner or a householder. So if you owned a house, then you were Lord of that house because you were the owner of it. But then the word also had a very much uplifted meaning, because the word Lord was used in the New Testament days to mean the expected Messiah. So the Jews in Jesus' time were looking forward to the Messiah, the Savior, coming, and they would refer to him as, "We expect the Lord to come at some stage." And Luke 2 verse 11 is an example of how you could look that up when you got home if you wanted to. And fourthly, you go right to the top, and if you look in the Old Testament, you often, in pretty well every translation, find the word Lord quite often in capitals. And this is when it is the name of God, and in the Hebrew, they didn't ever want to write or pronounce the name of God, so they just used a Hebrew word for Lord, and we translate that in the Old Testament as in capitals now, when they actually used that word, because in those days they used a Greek translation of the Old Testament for everyday use, and that was how it looked. So Lord, from ordinary master of a servant through to God himself, you could use that. So Thomas was calling Jesus my Lord, and he could have meant all sorts of things by that. Certainly he was saying, "Jesus, you're my boss. And you may be more." But he didn't just say that. Did you notice? He said, "My Lord and my God." So here you have something huge. It's the first and possibly the greatest admission or confession of Jesus' divinity in the whole of the New Testament. A lot more than Lord, because God can only mean God, and Lord can mean lots of things. So what it means is that Thomas acknowledged Jesus as God, as divine. He said, "My God." And this status of Jesus as God himself is something that tended to grow out, to dawn fairly gradually on the apostles and the early believers. We have quite a few instances in the New Testament where, when you read what they said or what they wrote, it seems that in there they're trying to say Jesus is God, but they just didn't say it as clearly as Thomas did. And it was quite some time before the early church, because it got so tangled up in its theology in so many respects, actually got a definition of Jesus as God. So it tended to dawn gradually. But here is Thomas saying, just a week after the resurrection, "My Lord and my God." So he's ahead of the game. So good old Thomas, is that who you call doubting Thomas? No, he's well ahead of the game. And third, and don't underestimate the significance of this, he said, "My Lord and my God." So we have the word "my," and we have it twice. Why didn't Thomas just save his breath and say "my Lord and God"? Easier, isn't it? He said "my Lord and my God," and it rather reminds me of Abba and Mamma Mia, doesn't it? "My, my, how can I resist you?" Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's coming to you, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. And tomorrow morning, when we do take three, and I'm leading it this time, we're going to think of Abba, for those who are coming, but we're going to think of Abba as the Greek term in the New Testament. So how about that for a twist on it? And I might even take the words along and get us to sing it. Or not. We'll have to see how it goes. But it was significant that he said, why? The first time he said, my Lord. So he could have been referring to Jesus as the boss, the Lord in general, but no, he said, my Lord. Not everyone's Lord, not other people's Lord, but personally, my Lord. Or indeed, if you want to put Lord in capitals, as it were, like I was talking about in the Old Testament, you could say, my Lord. And what it really means is that he is just instantly given 100% of himself to Jesus. You're my Lord. I belong to you. You belong to me, 100%. Wow, you're my Lord. But he wasn't finished yet. He wanted to accentuate with the word my that he was my God. You're my God. Not just an unknowable God, because it was traditional that it is now that you don't kind of know God, as if to pass him in the street and say, oh, hi, how are you? He's not as unknowable. Nor is Thomas referring to God when he says, my God, as just the almighty creator of life, the universe, and everything. That was in one of these science fiction comedies, wasn't it? Life, the universe, and everything. I think I've got the book that... Sorry? That was it, yes. Yes, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Anybody read or watch that? Two of us so far? Yeah, okay. It was a few years ago, wasn't it, John? Yeah. But Thomas went further, not just as a creator of everything, but as a personal, a spiritual, a one-to-one relationship. My God. And that was quite radical for him to say, my God. Who are you? What right have you to say my God as if he belongs to you? But we belong to each other. So my Lord and my God. Wow, what a thing to say. So after saying that, the rest of the period to the ascension goes on. I won't say as normal, but you know what I mean. But what became of Thomas? Well, he remained with the other disciples between that event and Pentecost, and we hear one or two references to his name, but there's no mention of Thomas after Pentecost. And the reason behind that is that he's believed to have founded what we now know today as the Martoma Church, which is in India. Anybody heard that? It's not a story or a fable, it's actually pretty correct history. What is believed is that he actually was able, and his particular calling was to go over to India. Now, it was very easy to get to India in those days because you just had to go down to the top of the Red Sea and you could catch a boat that was on the spice route to go down to southwest India. And it was a very common way of sailing these days. And in the Acts of the Apostles and so on, we mainly hear about the gospel being taken on its route to Rome, because that, in a sense, is the aim that Luke has in writing the Acts of the Apostles. He wants to tell us that, and it's why we have that account there. But also, there are other of the apostles who went south, and Thomas particularly. It's quite reliably believed that he went over on one of those sailings to southwest India and founded what today is known as the Martoma Church. And apparently it was a real surprise to British missionaries, because they were the first missionaries to really go worldwide into what was becoming the empire and so on. and to take Christianity into a lot of other countries. And the first British missionaries were thinking, we'll go to India now and we'll tell them all about Jesus because they don't know anything about him. And they got to Southwest India, and guess what they found? A thriving church saying, oh yeah, Thomas came and founded us. What an amazing thing to happen, wasn't it? And Thomas could have made that journey quite straightforwardly because the sailing route was there. And the Martoma Church is still a very significant denomination in that part of India. To show where it roughly was, it was in Kerala State and in that sort of area. But that's the Martoma churches today. If you just look up on Googling or other similar things about the Martoma Church, it will tell you where they're spread, and they're still very much located in that part of India. And quite a lot of their churches have been rebuilt in not so long ago times. That's one of them in the southwest India, isn't it? And that's quite an interesting looking place. So what a way to end up, unless to that. Well, so much for Thomas, but what becomes of us in that situation if we have our Thomas moment sometimes? There could be times when we say, unless. If we feel missed out by God, or if we feel let down, or if we say things, well, you know, why did God let somebody die who meant so much to me? Or why did God meant somebody lose his job when he really didn't need to lose his job? If we feel missed out by God or let down by him and we want things our way, like Thomas did, and that does happen to many of us in times, what we find is that time goes by while we still think that. And quite often, it's quite a long time while we're saying, God, please won't you do this for me? I need this to happen. I need this to happen. Well, think about the fact with Thomas, it was a week later, time goes by, because we said, unless. The result of unless is a week later. Oh, but sorry, let me go back. And then, even though we have closed the door, because you remember in Thomas's time, the week after Easter, the doors were closed again. So even after, by our unless, we've closed the door and time has gone by, guess what? He still comes to us in an unexpected way. And he rekindles our faith stronger than before. And we can be a Thomas in that we can say, in our way, my Lord and my God, instead of unless. And lastly, when we do give our all to God, who knows where it will lead? Oh yes, it always leads, almost always, somewhere quite surprising. But we have to be prepared for that. But how can you close that kind of thinking? Well, John's Gospel in the first edition seemed to close immediately after that Thomas episode. So it led on to the final couple of verses of our Bible reading, which just says this. And how can we close? Well, think of this, and when we get home, look it up perhaps in John 20. The disciples saw Jesus do many other miraculous signs in addition to the ones recorded in this book. But these are written so that you may continue to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing in him, you will have life by the power of his name. Just have a think on those words for a second or two. Aren't they meaningful? Celtic blessing that's on the screen now. Christ be with me. Christ within me. Christ behind me. Christ before me, Christ beside me, Christ to win me, Christ to comfort and restore me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ in quiet, Christ in danger, Christ in hearts of all that love me, Christ in mouth of friend and stranger. Amen.